Second case, U.S. versus Hicks, 093608. Ms. Childress-Jones, are you ready to proceed?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Dana Childress-Jones. I am the attorney for the appellant in this matter, the defendant below, Billy L. Hicks, Jr. This is a case at the jury trial which resulted in a guilty verdict against Mr. Hicks, and as a consequence, Mr. Hicks is now serving life in a federal prison. As Mr. Hicks or any criminal defendant would likely concede, Your Honors, defendants are not entitled to a perfect trial, but they certainly are entitled to a fair trial, especially in light of, in this case, Mr. Hicks finds himself facing life imprisonment. As our brief indicates, we have five arguments, Your Honor, in our brief. And the first argument, we believe all the arguments are very critical, but the first argument, our argument one, entails or involves a juror. And it's our contention that the judge interjected himself into this case and disrupted the juror composition. What happened in this case, Your Honor, is indicated in our brief. There is one juror during the course of the defendant's case. One of the jurors let the judge know that she recognized one of the witnesses.
It was the defendant's girlfriend, wasn't it?
That is correct. The juror knew, and the thing about this case, the juror, Miss Hampton, she had never ever met.
But the voice started
to
sound familiar.
They had a working relationship. And when the judge, when we were picking the jury, the judge, of course, as all judges typically do, listed the names of potential witnesses. Miss Hampton acknowledged the fact she didn't even recognize the witness's name, didn't recognize the witness's face. It was only she recognized the witness's voice. And then once the witness testified as to where she worked, Miss Hampton realized they worked at the same company. They had never met. They only talked over the phone.
But frequently.
Frequently. That is correct, Your Honor. Frequently.
Almost on a daily basis as part of their work, and she regarded her as friendly.
But, Your Honor.
So you got a real uphill battle on this one because, you know, that is certainly a sufficient grounds for the court to dismiss a jury, and this particular juror, especially since it's an abuse of discretion standard here.
Your Honor, under Federal Rule 24, it makes it clear that the juror has to be unable or disqualified to perform. The judge, outside of the presence of the other jurors, questioned Ms. Hampton, questioned her repeatedly. He also allowed counsel to question her. Ms. Hampton made it clear. She could be fair, she could be impartial, and in fact, she told the judge, I don't consider us having a relationship. And they actually hadn't worked. I believe Ms. Hampton had left the job in 08, so they hadn't been to get work together in over a year, Your Honors. And so we believe that, in fact, page 303 of the record is the colloquy. In that colloquy, which we have in our short appendix, page 95, the judge more or less said, he used the word notwithstanding. So the judge actually, on page 303 of the trial record, he more or less said, notwithstanding what she said, I'm going to get rid of her, in other words.
I'm a little curious about that, too.
Yes,
the government didn't move to have this juror stricken, did it?
Not at all, Your Honor. Not at all.
The judge did this sua sponte.
That's correct, Your Honor. And at sidebar, we objected. And Mr. Hicks is an African-American male. We had two African-American males on the jury. And, in fact, in foreshadowing, and in that same colloquy on page 303, I actually said to the judge in foreshadowing that I just believe that disqualifying Ms. Hampton is going to basically adversely affect Mr. Hicks. And talking about jury disqualification, we have to talk about prejudice. Well, to actually get to the prejudice in this case, we'd have to go to the juror's deliberative process. Of course, I couldn't do that. But in foreshadowing that in that colloquy, I'll turn the court's attention to page 303 of the record, I actually foreshadowed telling the judge to disqualify Ms. Hampton is going to affect Mr. Hicks. And in fact, Your Honors, we did cite to a case in which we believe in the Humphrey case, the court, the United States versus Humphrey, the court said when a juror says he or she can be impartial, the court actually, Humphrey said that is a legitimate basis to keep the juror. So we believe the judge, he changed the composition of the jury on his own, again, over our objection. And again, and I think by using that word notwithstanding, so in other words, the judge is saying, I don't care what she said, I'm going to get rid of her. And from a policy, we think from a rule of violation, but also more importantly, Your Honors, from a policy standpoint, we believe Rule 24 is there for a reason. So for a judge to say, basically, notwithstanding what she said.
Well, maybe what he meant was, I know she says she'll be fair, but in reading how she answers the questions and the depth of her knowledge of this witness, that wouldn't be possible.
Your Honor, the judge was clear, in my opinion, that he believed her. And he even said she's a lovely lady. He was clear he believed her. But so we believe the judge took it upon himself to disqualify her, and we believe that was error. So again, if we allow that as a policy consideration, we are basically throwing Rule 24 out the window, in my opinion, to say, forget about disqualification, forget about unable, the judge himself. So in this case, the government didn't disqualify her, the judge did, and we believe that's an error. And the second argument, Your Honor, I'm going to turn to our accomplice liability. In this case, throughout the case, we did file, as we were supposed to, an entrapment defense. We made it clear throughout, we didn't know if we were going to go forward with the entrapment defense.
And the court had ruled on the 404B motion before you made that determination?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, the morning of trial, Mr. Hicks still did not know. We had to file the entrapment defense, but the morning of trial, we still did not know if Mr. Hicks was going to take the stand. But
so just to get the sequence right, when did he file his entrapment defense notifying the government and the prosecution? Was it after you had the ruling on the 404B, right?
It was after. It was after.
And I hope you're going to get to your 404B argument.
I am going to get to that, Your Honor. Well, I'll go to that now then, Your Honor. We'll go to the 404B. 404B is very important. In this case, again, when we talk about criminal matters, we're talking about a person's liberty. In this matter, we're talking about Mr. Hicks' life. 404B should be like a forbidden, don't try the defendant on his past. And in fact, in my closing argument, I told the jurors, don't try Mr. Hicks on his past. Try him because of what he's charged with today. The government's closing argument spoke a lot about Mr. Hicks' past.
Did you announce your entrapment defense in your opening statement?
Your Honor, we waived opening statement.
Okay. Because so there was no mention of entrapment in opening statement.
Not at all, Your Honor.
And during your examination of the witnesses about the transaction, were you taking the position that your client was involved in the transaction or not involved in the transaction? Or how did you approach that?
That he was not involved. With the 404B, Your Honor, we purposefully waived the opening statement, because, again, we were hoping not to have to take the entrapment defense, depending on how the trial went. So, again, going back to the 404B, Your Honor, pretrial ruling, the judge allowed 404B. We filed an objection to it, and we also filed a motion to reconsider, because we felt, Your Honor, that Mr. Hicks had three prior drug convictions. And we did file our objection to the state's motion, and we also filed a motion to reconsider.
Didn't the government contend that the purpose of 404B evidence there was to show knowledge that it was crack and absence of mistake?
Correct, Your Honor.
But not intent.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And wasn't that the trial judge's ruling, that it was being admitted for those two purposes only, but not to show intent?
Correct, Your Honor.
But in the instruction given to the jury, the limiting instruction on 404B, intent was included, wasn't it?
And the problem with that, Your Honor, exactly, the problem with that, Mr. Hicks never put that in issue. And our fear was, in objecting to the 404B, in addition to asking for reconsideration, our fear was, Your Honor, this, and I think the words I used in quotes, this is a backdoor attempt to charge Mr. Hicks on his past. And that's exactly what happened. We believe in allowing 404B, in the trial record, I told the judge, Your Honor, in essence, this court is forcing Mr. Hicks to take the stand. And the court disagreed with that, and I respected that. However, we believe Mr. Hicks had a choice. Do I defend my honor, or do I sit still?
So that's why I wanted to know the sequencing of the rulings and everything, because that was a strong point, or a point you made, that you were caught in almost a catch-22, because once it came in, he had to take the stand, or if he didn't, it sort of fait accompli, especially when you look at what that final instruction ended up being, including the intent, that is.
That is correct. The 404B ruling, the judge allowed that prior to our filing a notice of entrapment. But even with that ruling, we were still uncertain. That's why I waived opening argument, because I did opening statement, because I didn't know how it was going to go.
And so the drug evidence, the 404B evidence, correct, was the very last thing put into before the jury just before the government arrested his case, right?
That is correct.
The ultimate evidence.
Well, that in addition to the recordings of the unavailable confidential informant. And so
that came in earlier.
That came in earlier. That's correct. So we believe Mr. Hicks was tried on his past, because in this case before the district court, Mr. Hicks was charged with distributing cocaine. No one. The government had helicopters, they had surveillance. No single government witness was able to say they saw Mr. Hicks. No witness was able to say they saw Mr. Hicks distribute cocaine. But the problem is we had the 404B. So we also objected to the admission of the recordings.
You're in your rebuttal time, but however you want to use it.
You still have time. You had reserved, I think, 7 minutes maybe. So you're just into your time. So you can continue.
I'll continue.
You can make your point. It's just eating into rebuttal. But go ahead.
And so we believe with the recordings, we believe Mr. Hicks' Sixth Amendment rights are violated, because the government said it was to put it in context. But again, we don't believe it's put in context. It was hearsay. So we put that 404B evidence, his past, and then his Sixth Amendment right was violated because, again, the confidential informant was unavailable. So we're seeing Mr. Hicks, his 404B, his past is on the line. Also, we have a recording of an unavailable confidential informant. So we had the 404B and the recordings. At that point, Mr. Hicks almost had no choice but to take the stand. And in the government's brief, they're saying even if 404B was inadmissible because Mr. Hicks had an entrapment defense, but our position is the government cannot be allowed to shift the burden. They had already put the forbidden evidence into evidence. So by the time Mr. Hicks took the stand, the 404B evidence was in, the recordings was in. So for the government to say, oh, well, even if it was inadmissible, he took the stand. But our position, as we argued in our brief and in our reply brief, the government should not be allowed to say, well, he took the stand, because they were allowed to get that in the case in chief.
Did you suggest to the judge that he defer ruling on the 404B question until the end of the defense case?
We did not. We asked for a reconsideration, which was denied.
Right. I mean, these rulings were all made in limine, but, you know, the correct procedure, it seems to me, would have been for the judge to defer ruling on this until the close of the defense case, since the proffered reasons for introducing this evidence, that is to say knowledge and absence of mistake, were not contested, and the only reasonable basis to admit this evidence would have been on the entrapment defense, and it remained to be seen whether that would be offered. So the proper procedure would be to defer ruling until the close of the defense case and let the government bring it in rebuttal if there was that sort of a defense.
We did ask for, at the end of the government's case, we did ask for a Rule 29, which the judge did take under advisement. He actually ruled on that after the trial. And also, our fifth argument, I know I'm running out of time, our fifth argument was something we thought was very, very critical, the jury instruction. We tendered an entrapment jury instruction, which the court gave. Over our very strong objection, the court allowed the government's accomplice liability. We objected very strongly because we told the judge, Mr. Hicks is being charged as a principal. To allow the government to put in the accomplice liability, we believe it's error. We objected very strongly. However, the judge allowed it in. So we asked the judge, if you're going to allow the accomplice liability in, we're asking you, Your Honor, to at least give the entrapment defense after the accomplice liability. The judge denied that, saying it's already covered. But as we indicated in our brief in the Johnson case, when you have an affirmative defense such as entrapment, you have to make sure the jurors are not confused. It's our belief, clearly, again, no one saw Mr. Hicks distribute cocaine. So it's our belief the only way Mr. Hicks could have been convicted was under the accomplice liability theory. And we believe under the Johnson case, we believe the jurors were confused. Because on the one hand, we tendered the entrapment defense. And the way the judge gave the instructions, he did give the entrapment defense. He gave the underlying offense. Then he did say the defendant has tendered an entrapment defense.
All right. You're out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ondurak. But I will give you a minute, counsel. We had a lot of questions for you in rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Matthias Ondurak. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Indiana. First, in regards to issue number one, the dismissal of the juror, the district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing the juror at issue because the district court gave a legitimate basis for dismissing that juror. Specifically, the district court noted that the juror spoke with the defense witness almost on a daily basis and that the juror considered the defense witness a friendly coworker. So they did have a personal relationship, and it was an ongoing relationship that occurred for a number of years on a daily basis. This was all articulated by the district court judge in stating the reasons for dismissing the juror, and we believe it's a legitimate basis.
But why did the judge do that on his own with no request from the government?
Well, Your Honor, I think, and if you look at the transcript, I personally didn't move for a dismissal for cause. It didn't get that far. However, the questioning that I did of the juror elicited responses that indicated the juror was biased. And immediately after that, the judge, who conducted the inquiry himself, determined that the juror was potentially biased, dismissed that juror, and gave a legitimate basis for that.
And specifically, the questions you asked, other than ferreting out the fact that she talked to her on a regular basis and was at the same job, was there anything else?
The friendly coworker, and I'm not certain, Your Honor, but
there was no point where she said, I don't think I can be fair because I talk to this woman all the time.
Correct, Your Honor, but I believe the district court's inquiry of a juror bias goes beyond one simple question asking the juror, do you believe you're biased? She said she thought she could be impartial. However, she did divulge her friendly coworker relationship with the defense witness and that it was ongoing. We believe that's a legitimate basis. Would every district court judge dismiss that juror for a legitimate basis? I don't know, but the standard is whether or not it's a legitimate basis, and we believe it is in regards to that. Moreover, we believe the defendant Hicks has not demonstrated prejudice because of the juror's dismissal. All that happened after juror Hampton was dismissed was that the district court seated an alternate juror. That alternate juror was picked in the voir dire by both myself and defense counsel, and that's all that occurred was that the alternate juror was seated in replace of a juror that was deemed to be potentially unbiased. So we don't believe the defendant indicated bias. Indeed, no one side had an advantage after the alternate juror that was picked in voir dire was seated.
So now will you move to this 404B issue?
Yes,
Your Honor. Hicks admitted that he intended to arrange for the July drug sale, but argued that the method by which he was persuaded to do so was entrapment. So his intent was not in dispute. Why would evidence going to that issue be relevant?
Your Honor, that
absence of mistake was not in dispute either.
I disagree, Your Honor. The bone of contention during our case in chief, before all this entrapment issue, the bone of contention was whether or not the defendant was an innocent bystander, an unwitting bystander in that house, or whether the defendant was a knowing participant. Knowledge was so central to that argument. And indeed here,
Not knowledge, participation.
Now, knowing,
there was no question that he knew it was crack or that, mm-hmm. that he disputed that it would be crack.
No.
It was whether he was a participant in the transaction.
A knowing participant. In other words, did he intend for that drug deal to go down, and did he know that that drug deal was going down? The defense argument during the entire case in chief, and this was elicited in the cross-examination of both Special Agent Jaycox and Officer Maxey, who were on surveillance, the argument was nobody knows what happened in that house because law enforcement did not see into that house because Tony Hurd, of course, was murdered and unavailable. So the police could not see into that house. There was also testimony about background noise indicating, and this is on cross-examination eliciting testimony, there was background noise in that house. The indication there was that there were other drug dealers in that house that had nothing to do with Billy Hicks. So the key issue, and that was the bone of contention, was he a knowing participant or was he an unwitting bystander? And so the 404B evidence proved knowledge and absence of mistake in regards to Billy Hicks, the defendant, knew darn well what he was doing, and also intent in that he intended to make that drug deal succeed.
But you asserted in your offer of it that intent was not the purpose of it, and the judge even made that determination that it was not admitted for purposes of intent.
Until the judge decided to give the accomplished liability instruction, which put intent at issue as well. In other words, even
after the ruling was made, long mm-hmm. after
the judge made a final ruling after our case in chief, and this was presented right before we rested, and the judge then allowed the 404B evidence in. Certainly the judge...
His ruling was well before trial.
Contingent on how the trial played out, yes, it was going to come in, but how the trial played out, I mean, there was a final...
There's nothing contingent in his written entry. It's going in. It's admitted.
It's my understanding until the final objection was made, which it was, he could have let the 404 be in or not.
Well, anything is possible, but his ruling was pretty ironclad. He said it's coming in.
Based on the facts he had in front of him,
but he didn't say in his ruling, based on what I know now, it's coming in. But if I learn something later, I may reconsider. That wasn't what he said.
Correct, Your Honor, but the facts he was relying on are the ones that I articulated here.
Now,
we don't know what happened.
The issue arose when the defendant took the stand and said something to the effect, now, wait a minute, I may have introduced some people, but I wasn't involved in the transaction.
And Judge, I disagreed. It was always an accomplice case, in my opinion, because...
Did you submit an accomplice instruction prior to trial? You did submit proposed instructions prior to trial, didn't you?
I don't know necessarily, Your Honor. However, this case...
It was
case
always an accomplice case. You would have had, that would have been your theory. We would have heard about it in the opening statement.
I think everybody involved in the case knew there was going to be no witnesses that saw Billy Hicks actually take the crack cocaine and hand it over to Tony Hurd. And so it was always going to be whether or not he arranged that deal. In fact,
when you just answered Judge Tinder's questions, when you submitted jury instructions before the trial started, right?
I believe so, Your Honor, and I don't know.
Okay, but there was no accomplice instruction in it.
I don't believe so.
In the initial draft of the instructions.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I don't know if I submitted.
That's what his question was getting to. If everybody knew, then why wasn't there that instruction?
Right, and I don't know if I even submitted it.
My read is it became your theory of the case after the defense was presented.
It was always that the defendant intended to arrange this. But regardless, after that occurred, then the final instruction included knowledge, lack of mistake, and intent for the reasons for that 404B evidence.
Well, mistake was never an issue, right?
In regards to knowledge, whether he's a knowing participant, I believe it was.
Mistake was never an issue.
I believe it was an issue, Your Honor.
How?
Because the defense argument was that he just was a hapless fool who took Tony Hurd into a building where Tony Hurd got crack cocaine.
A mistake defense is, I didn't know that this was a controlled substance. That was never the defense here. The defense initially, before the defendant's hand was forced by the 404B ruling, the defense was, I didn't participate. Not that I didn't know what was going on in the house, but I didn't participate.
I believe the defense was I didn't know what was going on in this drug deal, because certainly Tony Hurd got drugs from somebody in that house.
I thought, like Judge Sykes, it was I didn't participate. That's different.
I think it was always I didn't know what was going on in that house. I didn't know what I was doing when I led Tony Hurd into that house so that he could get crack cocaine.
So is it your position that every time a defendant with prior convictions asserts an entrapment defense, his prior conviction should be admissible?
In entrapment, and Your Honor, this is a different issue. If it's an entrapment defense, propensity to commit the crime is something we have to prove. In other words, that he wasn't predisposed. So if it's a drug dealing crime and these drug dealing offenses occurred recently, I think it is certainly admissible to show propensity. That's the whole entrapment defense, is that he was not predisposed. And which brings up my next point, in that after entrapment came in, we believe the error was harmless because the entrapment defense comes in, and then those 404B convictions that we were talking about, Your Honor, those all of a sudden become used not just for knowledge, lack of mistake, and intent, but for his predisposition to commit the crime.
So what's your response to counsel's position that the whole reason he took the stand was because of the 404B ruling in advance, that he would not have taken the stand if that testimony hadn't come in? That's how I understand her theory.
Your Honor, the prejudicial effect of the 404B evidence was limited by the court's repeated instructions that it's only to be used on those specific points, and also the way in which we presented it, which was at the end of the case.
Why doesn't it make more sense what Judge Sykes said, that it should have waited until the court should have made that final determination on 404B once the defense case was presented?
Because it was important on the two issues or three issues that we had to show after our case in chief.
Well, we've already established
not just
that
entrapment
and mistake were not really at issue.
You had to show after your case in chief?
Well, I mean, we presented the case in chief. The defendant could have stopped there, relied on the presumption of innocence, relied on the fact that we had a very high burden of proof, and we would have not have gotten that 404B evidence in that was on the issue.
It came in at the end of your case as the ultimate piece of evidence right before you sat down.
Yes, Your Honor, and I was referring to the question of waiting until after their case to present the 404B evidence. My point is that may have never occurred. I had no idea that
it's classic impeachment once he takes the stand. Mm-hmm.
But I had no idea, Your Honor, I had no idea whether entrapment was going to be raised or whether or not he took the stand. I was presenting evidence in a limited capacity to prove issues that we had to show in order to find him guilty.
Well, I've got to say I'm very troubled that it appears it was offered for propensity. Yeah, it's very troubling evidence.
Not until after the entrapment defense came in was it for predisposition. But before that, it was on the issue of knowledge, lack of mistake, and did he intend to arrange this drug deal?
Did he intend? Well, he intended because he had done it on other occasions.
No, sir. No, sir. Did he know what was going on inside that house?
How does it go to intent unless it's propensity?
For accomplice liability, we have to show that the defendant intended to arrange the drug deal. In other words, did he intend to make that drug deal succeed?
But so, that's after the accomplice liability became an issue, which wasn't until he took the stand, which was after the 404B evidence was already in.
And again, I think we were always going to present some form of accomplice liability because nobody saw, on account of Tony Hurd being murdered, nobody saw a hand-to-hand drug exchange. Nobody testified to a hand-to-hand drug exchange.
So in your opening statement, did you explain to the jury your theory? Was it explained?
Yes, Your Honor. It was explained that there would be nobody's going to see this hand-to-hand exchange. All we're going to show you is that Billy Hicks spoke on the phone and other things, but went into the house with Tony Hurd. When Tony Hurd came out, he had the 100 grams approximately of crack cocaine. Nowhere did I mislead the jury.
Referred to as an accomplice?
Right, because he arranged for that. In what I relayed, yes, it was referred to that nobody's going to say there was a hand-to-hand exchange between Tony Hurd.
Is there the word accomplice used in the opening statement?
Your Honor, I do not know. And again, we believe it's harmless error in light of the fact that an entrapment occurred afterwards. The defendant was not made or forced to make this entrapment defense, which was untruthful. The defendant could have relied on the presumption of innocence, which was made clear to the jury from the beginning, and the defendant could have relied on our high burden of proof. Indeed, that's how the trial started. That was the cross-examination, that we have this burden of proof and that nobody saw the drug deal inside that house, at least no testimony.
He could have relied on that even though, as Judge Tender has pointed out, all this 404B evidence came at the end of your case. There was no clarification at that point. The court didn't make any finding, additional finding on 404B at that point either, right?
No, other than that it's in for knowledge, lack of mistake, because of how the trial played out, that the district court had a chance to see. Again, the bone of contention was knowledge, a knowing participant or an innocent bystander. The other issues, I don't know if the court would like me to address any one specifically, but just to go through the next one on the audio recording conversations, case law is clear that the Tony Hurd portion of those conversations was to put the Billy Hicks definitional non-hearsay conversations into context.
Well, I'm curious about that. So you're saying you're not offering them for the truth of the content, just for the context.
Not Tony Hurd's, correct.
So why did you have your expert agents interpret the words that Hurd used?
Because in order
that,
to
that sounds like it's offered for the truth, if what those words mean is an issue.
No, sir, because what Tony Hurd said would not make any sense unless you had a interpretation of that word. There was still context as far as why Billy Hicks responded. For instance, if I can just give an example, when Tony Hurd said, ask, you know, what's the ticket, meaning what's the price of crack cocaine, and Tony Hurd said that, and Billy Hicks responds 4 or 5, meaning $450 per ounce. If they didn't understand what's the ticket, you would have no way of understanding the non-hearsay response of Billy Hicks. So it was all to put it into context, but you have to understand one end of the conversation to understand the response on the other end.
It was an effort to explain what the words meant.
What the words meant in order to understand why Billy Hicks's response was what it was.
If it's the context, all you need is what words were said, not what they meant.
No.
What they meant goes to the truth of those words, the truth of that statement.
And I disagree when they say what's the ticket. The jury has to understand what that words mean in the drug context to understand the response. Otherwise, the 4-5 would not make any sense if you didn't understand the question to begin with. And these were to have the jurors understand the question. And again, there was no objection there. There was an objection there, but we also believe that it was needed to make sense. And put it all in context. They had to understand what the question was, and that's why the expert came about. And we believe there's two cases there, U.S. v. Tolliver and U.S. v. Van Sack, on point in regards to putting the non-hearsay questions into context. I believe my time's up. There's any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
No other questions. Thank you. Ms. Childress-Jones, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Your Honors, to address the question, the theory of accomplice liability was never an issue until Mr. Hicks took the stand.
Was there an innocent bystander defense?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was there an innocent bystander defense?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. And as I recall, the government's opening was my guy did it. My guy was the person who distributed. The accomplice liability only came in after the government's case in chief. And looking at the transcript, I strongly objected to it, but it came in. So as I said, when I first stood before you, Mr. Hicks understands and understood he was not entitled to a perfect trial, but he was certainly entitled to a fair trial. It's our position that Mr. Hicks was denied a fair trial from start to finish. Start being the judge taking it upon himself to excuse a juror who clearly and unequivocally said she could be fair and impartial. So we believe that was a Rule 24 violation. In the finishing part, again, we objected to the accomplice liability, but again, Mr. Hicks took the stand only because his 404B was in, the Sixth Amendment violation on the recordings was in, so Mr. Hicks had a tough decision. Do I sit here and let my priors convict me, or do I take the stand? So we believe he was forced into that. But our question is, and when I did ask the judge, Your Honor, we'd object to accomplice liability, but if you're going to do it, at least instruct on entrapment. We believe the judge denied that. We believe to not instruct on the entrapment of the accomplice liability, we believe the jurors could have very well been confused.
Well, the entrapment instruction was given. It was just given before the accomplice liability instruction and not repeated. You wanted it repeated.
Correct. Okay. Our fear, Your Honor, was the jurors could be left to believe, okay, the instruction's read, he's tried as a principal, and he's asserting entrapment. So as a principal, entrapment works. But the absence of that after the accomplice liability, our fear was the jurors. We don't know. We can't go into the deliberative process. But our fear is clearly Mr. Hicks was convicted because of the accomplice liability. Clearly, no one saw him distribute anything. And until that accomplice liability came in, again, Mr. Hicks was being charged as a principal. If you look at my argument throughout the trial, our argument was, Your Honor, Mr. Hicks has been tried from day one as a principal. So to allow the judge, the government at the 11th hour to throw in this accomplice liability, we fear is unfair. So our position was the jurors could have been confused, saying, well, entrapment works as a principal, but it doesn't apply as an accomplice liability. And we believe that could have caused juror confusion. And in the Johnson case, it makes it clear when you're doing an affirmative defense, the judge has to make sure he avoids juror confusion. So again, we believe from start to finish, from start allowing the juror to be excused, the judge did himself, we believe the 404B, he was convicted on his priors. In my closing, I said, don't convict Mr. Hicks on the man he used to be. Convict him on what he's charged with today.
All right. And your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Were you appointed?
Yes, Your Honor. I was private counsel at trial, but appointed here, Your Honor.
And so we thank you for your service to your client. We thank you for your fine arguments, both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.